My name is Beth Hessel. I am the executive director of the Presbyterian Historical Society in Philadelphia. It's the National Archives of the Presbyterian Church USA and all predecessor denominations.
I found you through the blog post. Could you tell me what was your aim writing it?
I wrote that blog post last year to mark the 75th anniversary of President Roosevelt's signing of Executive Order 9066, which enabled the government to incarcerate, remove from their homes and their livelihoods and incarcerate for much of the duration of the war nearly 120,000 Japanese Americans on the West Coast. And it seemed an appropriate time in light of the recent President Trump's recent executive orders banning immigration or even travel from many countries around the world that seemed to be based on religious orientation. So this article was an opportunity to look at how people of faith, Presbyterians in particular, had responded or failed to respond adequately at the time of after Pearl Harbor and with the executive order.
Kind of seeing some parallels there is.
Yes.
what is this idea of Christian witness?
Christian witness. That's a good question. It's an interesting way to put it. There's an understanding among some Christians, whether they be Catholics or Protestants, that Scripture calls us to not just personal sanctity, can we say, not just having a personal relationship with Jesus, but actually living that out in the social order. Not standing quiet when they see abuses to the basic human rights of other individuals.
Oh, so it's not just witness in terms of passively observing, but does it involve action?
Correct. I would say there would be many ways for Christian witness. For some, it may be prayer, but for many others, it's speaking out. It's protesting. It's working with others across the aisle, wherever you are, regardless of faith, on issues of human rights or the environment or whatever a person believes that their faith is calling them to witness to.
Yeah, this in the period between the Pearl Harbor bombing and the relocation, incarceration of the Japanese Americans. I mean, so what was going on with? What were the dynamics in the Presbyterian, I guess, community?
I would say across the faith spectrum, be it Protestant and any particular denomination, Roman Catholic, Jewish, the response was very muted to the increased attacks on the loyalty of Japanese Americans, both those who were longtime residents in the United States, unable to become citizens because of our naturalization laws, as well as those who were born here and were citizens. It was a very muted, very quiet response on the part of many people. On the other hand, you can say many people who considered themselves good Christians or Jews also participated in and supported the forced removal and incarceration of Japanese Americans. A survey done by the federal government on the West Coast across the country in the spring of 1942 found almost unanimous support for the removal of all residents or Issei, first generation Japanese Americans from the West Coast.
And
about 59% also supported the removal of Nisei, or second generation, who were citizens by right of birth.
And this is before the bombing of Pearl Harbor.
This was after the bombing. So this was 1942. Directly after the bombing in late 1941, in December 1941, there was a fairly calm response among people across the country, but in the West Coast in particular, in Hawaii, towards Japanese Americans, and there was generally support for the rights of Japanese Americans, but a number of politicians and newspaper press, particularly those that were owned by Randolph Hearst or the McClatchy, James McClatchy, started pushing stories claiming that Japanese Americans had participated in sabotage at Pearl Harbor, which investigations and reports that the government had carried out show that there is never, before Pearl Harbor, during Pearl Harbor, or during the course of the war, any acts of sabotage or espionage committed by Japanese Americans. But as these stories began to be spread, fear and hysteria emerged among the West Coast population, and there became a greater support for the removal, for moving Japanese Americans out of the West Coast. Some of this support came from groups like the American Legion, which no longer would support such, but at that time, many American Legion posts did support the removal of Japanese Americans. And Golden Sons of the Native Sons of the Golden West, who were a nativist organization. Organizations such as these saw this as a perfect opportunity that they had been waiting for to get rid of Japanese Americans from the West Coast. And they rallied around this cause.
What is this nativist idea?
There was a strong nativist movement.
This is not Native American.
No, this would be, as we see today, people back then, there was, you know, the America First movement. There was a nativist movement that believed only that America belonged only to white people. And those who were not white or Caucasian did not belong in the country and did not have rights. And though on the West Coast, we saw that really strongly in treatment of Asian Americans, be they of Japanese descent, Chinese descent, Filipino descent, there was a lot of suspicion. There were laws that were passed denying them the right to buy property if they were not citizens, to own property, other efforts made to limit their ability to belong in the country and fully flourish in the country. And this was part of that anti-immigrant, non-white, non-Protestant view of what America was supposed to be.
In the broad population, this is fascinating. Thank you so much, Beth. In the broad population, though, you say people either kind of chose to do nothing or actively approved of removing Japanese Americans.
Correct. And I would say, I mean, if you look across the United States, I've gone around and spoken all over the United States about this era, and find so many people say, wow, particularly as you get farther east, I never even knew. I didn't even know this was happening, and I was a child or a young adult in the 40s, and I had no idea that this was happening. So I think we see some parallels to today, even in our day of 24/7 news access for most people, is that there were many people who lived in their little bubbles who had never met anyone of Japanese ancestry.
So
today there are many people who've never met anybody who might be Muslim, or have never met anybody who might be an immigrant, a recent immigrant from one of the countries, from a Latin American country, for example, and have very little knowledge and understanding of what's happening. So there's that bubble. I think there's also complacency. At that time, there was a lot of trust in the government, in a president who had helped ameliorate the worst of the Great Depression, and we were at a time of war, and as we know, we tend to want to trust our government to do the right thing in a time of war. So I think people were wanting to believe that the president, even if they weren't sure it was the right thing, they wanted to believe that the government was doing the right thing.
Or that in the name of national security, this was the right thing for this moment?
Correct. And if the government is telling you it's the right thing for national security, you want to believe. If we think back to the Patriot Act and how that passed after 9/11, and people were concerned about the way the Patriot Act challenged and threatened some of our civil liberties. But overall, people said, well, we have to trust it's for the best. We need it for national security. So I think there was a lot of complacency, a desire to trust. There was the prejudice. There was that effect of, the term we use now is fake news. So the yellow journalism was what it was called back then, of spreading lies and rumors instead of giving the real facts of what was going on was very rampant in the newspapers. And so lies were being spread about the reality of who Japanese Americans were, which just increased people's likelihood not to trust Japanese Americans and their loyalty.
And maybe made it more likely for us to ignore some early signs of, breaches. Well, we allowed civil liberties to be breached because in the name of national security, I guess, is what we did. And we didn't notice some signs that there was a civil rights violation coming up, like firings maybe or curfews happening, those limits
Correct.
On property.
Correct. So I think
what were some signs and how would we act
now? People in the 1940s were the same as we are today, where we get so caught up in our own everyday lives and what's going on that we may not notice this may be just a side issue. And so not paying attention to the fact that in January 1942, for example, in California, Japanese Americans who worked for the government in civil service jobs were losing their positions, or that 6 months before the Pearl Harbor attack, the federal government had frozen all the Japanese bank accounts of Issei and Nisei, so they lacked access to their money, or that they were given in early 1942 after General DeWitt made much of the West Coast a military area, that he limited, he gave a curfew to Japanese Americans, and he also limited their travel to 5 miles from their home, which made it very difficult for people who were in school or had jobs to carry out their lives. And I think you're right. I don't think many people really paid attention to what was going on, or they believed this is for national security. It's for the best.
With hindsight, what?
That is a great, I do struggle with this. I see so many we didn't do, and there was a small group of folks who did fight. There were a lot of members of the American Friends Service Committee who were Quakers, wrestled with their belief that the government was doing wrong, and they didn't know if we helped Japanese Americans, are we being complicit in the government's unjust actions and unconstitutional actions. And many of them said, well, it doesn't matter. We need to help. And there were former missionaries to Japan and China and elsewhere who said, we need to stand up for what's right. And they were this small coterie that worked hard and tried to ease and ameliorate the experience of Japanese Americans, and also carried out a public relations campaign to try to change public opinion, especially with the hope that as the war ended, that Japanese Americans would be allowed to return to their homes.
A vain and unrealistic hope.
And well, ultimately, the military area was opened up, so Japanese Americans were allowed to return to the West Coast, and many did. Not many returned to the lives they had before. Many had lost everything already, but many did return to California. And had to rebuild their lives. But in hindsight, I would say, yeah, we didn't. people of faith are often, particularly Protestants, I'll stay in that realm, are very good at stepping up after a tragedy has happened to do something, but not as good at stepping out ahead of time. And we've seen a bit of a difference in the last year as people have really felt energized after President Trump's election to really stand up against what they see as violations of the Constitution and of our democratic values. So hopefully we won't get compassion fatigue and start, you know, getting in our own bubble and ignoring what's happening. But there are a lot of similar, there's a lot of similarities between then and today. Well, I would say between the challenges of all the conflicting news we get, the fact that we are overwhelmed almost by the number of crises that we're being presented with, and the fact, I think one difference too is that we had the executive branch and Congress were in agreement with each other, and today we have politicians who are willing to oppose. Not all, but there's enough who are willing to stand up and oppose and speak out when they see threats to our constitutional, to our constitution and to our democratic values. And we have a lot of activists at the ground, grassroots.
So you feel there's a bit more of a safety net. What should we do, though, for example, with some, this is a question that we're asking at the radio station. What should we do with some of these sort of what people might perceive as hateful ideas, ideas about separation and a lot of ideas espoused by the president, actually? I mean, should they be not discussed? Should they be kept more under... Should they not be given a forum? You know, should they be not be given the opportunity to attract more followers?
Well, that's a fascinating question. Probably a psychologist could give a great answer on what happens. I've seen some writing around about what happens when we even repeat the ideas. What I find fascinating, if we think back to 1942, most people still subscribed to the idea of race as a biological standard, and it wasn't something, you know, and therefore, as General DeWitt has been quoted as saying, and he was the military commander of the Western Defense Command, that a Jap is always a Jap. That doesn't matter how long they've been in the United States, you can never count on their loyalty. And that's a sort of biological racism. But in 1942, two prominent anthropologists, Ashley Montague and Ruth Benedict, separately published books that challenged biological racism, challenged the whole idea of race, and argued that, and in 1944, Gunnar Myrdal published his book, An American Dilemma, in which he argued that the American creed was the fundamental equality of all people. So you have this beginning idea of challenging the foundations of racism in 1942, and that's being they published it for the popular press, and more people are beginning to read and inculcate these ideas. But we're still finding it today in many of these statements and ideas that we're hearing, including from the highest levels of government, this almost biological idea of what it means.
But people say, I'm not racist. You know, I'm just fiscally conservative, you know, and just I care about law and order and those kinds of things.
Yes. They do. They do. And then we, I think we have to take their words and look at their words and look at their actions and see how they play out. And if an individual or organization's words and actions have racist repercussions, we need to call it for what it is. And I don't think we can be quiet about it. If the fact in 1942 we were dealing with the racism that we're still seeing today, and prejudice against immigrants, the idea of a closed society, without a willingness to understand the bigger picture of all that immigrants bring to our society, of the richness of our, the diversity of our culture, I think we need to, journalists and the average person in the street needs to voice the opposite story and needs to proclaim loudly who it is that we are.
Who are we?
Who are we? That's the question everybody seems to be asking right now. Who are we as Americans? And I would really love to believe that we are the Americans that supposedly we fought World War II to become, not the country that we were at that time with Jim Crow and placing 123 people just on the basis of their ancestry behind barbed wire, but the country that we were called to become, the country of liberty and freedom and justice, of equal and fair opportunity for everybody.
Yeah, something like global partnership kind of idea.
Right, right. You know, many of these missionaries who spoke out in early 1942 after Roosevelt issued his executive order, this commission, the Tolan Committee from Congress, did a series of hearings on the West Coast in major cities. And in order to determine the effects of potential evacuation and incarceration of Japanese Americans and get a sense of what people believed about it. And a number of the missionaries that I have studied stepped up. They were in the minority of people who spoke against evacuation, who argued for selective hearings of Japanese Americans, just as were being done for Italian American and German American or German Italian aliens or residents at that time. And what they argued from their long years of experience of living elsewhere in the world was that the choices that we make can have a negative or a positive impact on how the rest of the world sees us. And they spoke strongly about what kind of effect this decision to non-selectively remove all Japanese Americans from the West Coast and put them into basically prison camps would have on the rest of the world. When we claim to be fighting for democracy, this would say exactly the opposite.
Our very own concentration camps.
Exactly. Exactly. And so if we say that we are about liberty and democracy and freedom, and we believe that we are a place where anybody can come and have a second chance at life and succeed, and yet we bar our doors to people based on country of origin or perceived religious background or the color of their skin or for any of those other reasons, we have just failed to be that country that we claim to be.
Boy, Beth, thank you so much for showing me the value of history.
Well, thank you. It's I hope everybody will take a chance to learn a bit about what happened to Japanese Americans during the war. I think it's still prescient for today, and we can't stop. I think Gordon Chapman, who was one of the Presbyterian missionary who helped lead a group of missionaries and others in supporting Japanese Americans during the war, he said at one point that too many Christians, I think we say leave this here, too many Americans, from fear of fomenting disunity at a time of crisis, kept silent when the anti-Japanese forces were most vociferous. And I think that's a powerful quote for us today to consider why we stay quiet and why we might need to be brave and take a chance and speak up when we see something happening, whether it's the immigration laws, whether it's how the Dreamers are treated, whether it's the travel ban, that we need to speak up.
We'll leave it there. I can't think of a better place to leave it. Thank you so much, Beth. It's been great talking with you.
Thank you. It's been wonderful, delightful to talk to you, too.